Well, good afternoon and welcome to our final session for this Financial Services Forum. It's my great pleasure to introduce Aubrey de Grey. Dr. Aubrey de Grey is a biomedical gerontologist based in Mountain View, California in the US and is the Chief Science Officer at SENS Research Foundation, which is a California-based biomedical research charity that performs and funds laboratory research dedicated to combating the ageing process. In addition, he is Editor-in-Chief of Rejuvenation Research, the world's highest impact peer-reviewed journal focused on intervention in ageing. In his spare time, Aubrey is an amateur mathematician, and last Christmas, while he was on holidays for a little bit of relaxation, he actually made the first major advance in solving a 60-year-old graph problem called, I'll probably pronounce this wrong, the Hadwiger-Nelson problem. And since shortly after it was introduced in 1950, no one's really made much progress on it, and he actually made quite a fair bit of progress on it over Christmas. So a very interesting and very intelligent man. He's highly sought after around the world as a speaker, and we're very fortunate that he's agreed to come and present today. He's going to be talking to us about longevity in the 21st century, when medicine truly trumps extrapolation. He's going to talk for between 20 and 30 minutes, and then we'll have lots of time for questions. So please be thinking about and SMSing your questions through as we go. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Aubrey de Grey.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Well, thank you so much for that excellent introduction. I won't talk about math today unless you absolutely force me to, but I'm delighted to be here. I am always delighted to speak to people in the financial services industry, actually, especially actuaries, because, first of all, obviously, any real departure from past trends that might occur in the future with regard to longevity is very much your business, and something that I would hope that you would want to be able to anticipate better than you otherwise might. And secondly, because being a biologist, you know, it's kind of weird that I would be put up here to speak to people like this. So it really is, shows very, very strongly and gratifyingly that the message I've been trying to put forward over the past decade or two has really started to get through to the people whose lives are going to change the most and certainly the soonest. So I will try today, over the next 20 minutes, to give you, first of all, a very top-level overview of the work that we do at SENS Research Foundation and the general message of why it is plausible that aging will be brought under really comprehensive medical control in the next couple of decades. And then I'll spend a little time talking about what that means in terms of longevity. So, of course, since most people in the industrialized world tend to die from being sick, and most people tend to get sick from being old, we are likely to see something of a side effect of bringing aging under medical control in terms of how long people are likely to live on average. And I will be talking about the magnitude and the proximity of that side effect, but I shall also be talking about something towards the end, which may not be quite so obvious, namely that even though these medical advances are still some way off, the time for you folks to be thinking about them is very much nearer, because the people who pay you, in the rest of the financial services industry, the life insurance companies, the pension funds and so on, these people are going to have a very major dislocation in terms of the people who pay them, and I'm going to explain what you might be able to do about that. So, well, you all know that the population has been going up, has been aging over the past number of decades. This is just for illustration US statistics. And, of course, this is a great success story of civilization, of medicine, broadly defined. You know, it all started when we discovered that hygiene is a good idea, and we've been getting fairly good with things like mosquito nets, and then really elementary medicines like, you know, vaccines and antibiotics have done their bit as well. Long and short of it is, we've seen this very great increase in life expectancy across the world, and of course not just the industrialized world. We're seeing it very much now in the developing world. I think it's still the case that the last statistics from the World Health Organization for life expectancy around the world are from 2015. I'm looking forward to the next update on that. But I did notice when those statistics came out that it was the first time ever that there wasn't a single country in the world with a life expectancy lower than 50. And in fact, there wasn't a single country outside of sub-Saharan Africa with a life expectancy lower than 60. The shortest one was Afghanistan at 60.2 or something like that. So, you know, this really tells us that aging is a global problem, and it's likely to stay that way. Of course, the problem can be described in many ways. This is the economic way of describing it, again, just for illustration using US statistics. Medical budget, which is the blue line in the US, has been climbing over the years, and the GDP has also been climbing. And if you just look at the blue and green lines, nothing serious seems to emerge. But if you divide one by the other and you look at the red line, then you can see what's happening. And the impending catastrophe in terms of affordability of medical care. And, of course, the US is by no means alone in this. So, as I mentioned, you know, we've had this massive success in allowing people to get old enough to get sick from being old. But it would be kind of nice if we had another success and stopped people from getting sick when they were old either. And that doesn't seem to have occurred. And it's a little bit of a paradox that it hasn't. I mean, what's so different about the diseases of old age relative to the diseases that affect people early in life? Most people say it's this. It's just, you're not supposed to be able to read this slide, don't worry. It's just, you know, most people think it's just the complexity, that there's so many things that go wrong with us late in life, and they all go wrong at more or less the same time, which means that, you know, they interact and exacerbate each other. And it's just, you know, it's just too daunting. We just haven't been able to do it. Now, of course, that is part of the answer, no question. But it's actually not the main answer. In order to explain the main answer, I'm going to start by explaining what aging is in very, very fundamental, simple terms. It's a shock that one needs to actually do this. You'd think we kind of would have an agreed definition of aging by now. But even if you ask a dozen biologists what aging is, you'll get a dozen different answers at least. So aging can be described very, very simply in just these three words. So metabolism is the term that biologists use to denote and to encompass all of the processes that keep us alive from one day to the next. Obviously, a lot of processes. But it's just like they keep us alive. Unfortunately, they create damage. Through our life, even starting before we're born, they have side effects, molecular and cellular changes to the structure and composition of the body that progressively accumulate over time. And the body is set up to tolerate a certain amount of such change, so that's why aging is basically harmless for a long, long time. But eventually the amount of these changes, which I'm going to call damage, that exceeds the tolerance of what the body's set up for, and that's when things start to go downhill. So what we do at the moment against aging is this. We attack the pathologies of old age directly. We try to eliminate them from the body. We even talk about actually curing them. In other words, we use the same terminology that we would use for infections. And that is a bit daft, really, because the fact is, these pathologies are a side effect of being alive. I mean, here it is. You know, it took me three words to explain that, right? So it's bleeding obvious that any medicine that goes after the pathologies of old age directly is going to become progressively less effective as time goes on because the damage that's driving the pathologies is getting more and more abundant because metabolism is continuing to happen. Honestly. So the question is, you know, why are we making this mistake? Why has civilization gone down this ridiculous wrong path for so long? And the fundamental answer is shown on this slide. This slide is a depiction of the answer that you would typically get if you ask people the question, in what ways can one be sick? You know, if you ask for a taxonomy of sickness. People will say, well, yeah, right, there's infectious diseases, right? That's column one, easy. Then there's genetic ones that a few of us are unlucky to inherit. Then there's the big ones, the chronic progressive diseases of old age, like Alzheimer's, nearly all cancers, you know, atherosclerosis, osteoporosis, all the obvious things. And then most people would say that way out in the stratosphere over here, there's this fourth, completely separate thing called aging itself, which consists of all these, you know, rather nebulous, poorly defined things like frailty and, well, sarcopenia, that's the loss of muscle as we get older, immunosenescence, the decline in function of the immune system. You know, And people think that's completely different. Like, aging is just not a disease, and, like, it's not even a collection of diseases. It's just off-limits for medicine in most people's minds. And that is crazy. Here's why it's crazy. Aging is just... I mean, if you think about the definition that I've told you so far, aging is the same thing in the human body or in the body of any living organism as it is in a simple man-made machine, like a car or an aeroplane. It's not some kind of emergent phenomenon that's restricted to living organisms, like, you know, consciousness or something. It's simply a fact of physics that any machine that has moving parts, whether or not it's alive, is going to do itself this damage I'm talking about as a side effect of its normal operation. And any machine is set up to tolerate only a finite amount of that damage, and so eventually it starts to go downhill. That's all that aging is. And if you take that into account, then it's easy to see that column 3 was misclassified in my previous version of this table. In this version, in this corrected version of the table, all the columns are exactly the same. The only difference is the big black line is in the middle rather than on the right. And that tells you two critical things. First of all, it tells you that you should not be treating the diseases of old age, so-called, as if they were infections, because they're not amenable to elimination from the body. You can't eliminate a side effect of being alive without eliminating being alive, which would rather defeat the object. But the second thing it tells you, which is perhaps even more important, is that the things in column 3 are indistinguishable biologically from the things in column 4. The only difference is semantic. The things in column 3 are the aspects of aging that we have chosen to give disease-like names to, and the things in column 4 are the ones that we haven't, and that is all. Now, that is very handy for a couple of reasons. A big reason why it's handy is you can't realize that and keep thinking that aging is off-limits for medicine, because you've already decided that Alzheimer's disease, for example, is very much not off-limits for medicine. You know, we're trying our very best to fix it. So the question is just how to fix it that's not the same as the way we might fix infections. And I'm not the first person to think of all this. You know, this is a good way of describing this. More than a century ago, a few people started to realize that geriatric medicine was a mug's game. It was never going to work. And they said, well, look, let's try and intervene in this process at an earlier point in the chain of events. And they took their inspiration from the fact that in the living world, we see a huge variation in the rate of aging. Some species live a lot longer than others. They accumulate damage a lot more slowly than others. Even within a species, there's some variation, of course. So maybe we might be able to study this variation a lot and eventually figure out enough about it that we could translate our understanding into some kind of therapeutic approach. Great idea, you might think, because, of course, it would delay the accumulation of a pathogenic amount of damage, and therefore keep people healthier for longer. Loudly. No, because metabolism is rather complicated. This I'm showing you here is a simplified diagram of a small subset of what we know about how metabolism actually works. And as you can see, it's a bit... Hand up anyone here who writes software, or ever has. All right, quite a lot of you, right. Yeah, so you will immediately see that this is the ultimate nightmare of uncommented spaghetti code. There is absolutely no way on God's earth that we will ever be able to tweak this system into doing... It's not doing the thing we don't want it to do, the accumulation of damage, without also having unintended consequences that stop it from doing things that you need it to do to keep us alive. It's just not going to happen. All right, so that's a bit of a shame. And indeed, by the 1970s or 80s, gerontologists who were quite hopeful about this earlier on had pretty much come to that conclusion. And so they'd all kind of thrown up their hands and they'd become a bit like seismologists. You know, people who study... But seismologists, you know, they understand that the thing they're studying is bad for you, but they have no particular aspiration to do anything about it. It's just a case of, you know, get out. Thing is, though, this is complete nonsense, because there's a perfectly good alternative to either of these, a perfectly good third way. What our goal is, of course, is to separate metabolism, to separate being alive from being dead. And so far what I've done is I've divided that process of going from metabolism to pathology into two parts, right? And the geriatrics approach tries to attack the right-hand process, and the gerontology approach tries to attack the left-hand process, which is fine, and except that neither of them can do it. But you don't have to do that. You can leave those two component processes completely unaffected and still break the overall process simply by separating the two component processes from each other. And that is what I'm calling the maintenance approach does. It simply says, let's periodically go in and repair some of the damage every so often. if we do that, then we can let metabolism generate damage at the normal rate, and it still won't get to an overall load of damage that is pathogenic, that is bad for you. Now, of course, that might be easier said than done, but at least it's common sense. You know, it might actually work. And the brilliant thing is that it sidestepped all of our ignorance of the complexity I've already mentioned. So I showed you how ridiculously complex the pathologies of old age are, how many of them there are. So what? If we're not letting damage get to the level of abundance that causes the pathologies, we don't need to understand the mechanisms that are encapsulated in this right-hand arrow. And similarly, if we're not trying to slow down the rate at which metabolism generates damage, we don't need to understand all of the complexities that are inherent in the left-hand arrow. So that's wonderful. And indeed, whoa, what's happened there? Well, bollocks. That's supposed to be a picture of a car. A really nice 100-year-old car. You can find it on YouTube instead in some of the other talks. But anyway, so yeah, this is the car. And it's 100 years old, but it's still working just as well as when it was built. You know, obviously these cars exist. You can imagine them. So the thing is that these cars were not designed to last 100 years. They were designed to last maybe 10 or 15 years, just like cars today. And yet, there they are. Why? Answer, simply, they got lucky with their owners, and they have benefited from comprehensive, periodic, preventative maintenance. The exact same thing that I've just been talking about. That's all that is going on, and it works. Cars just completely transcend their warranty period by this means. And so do aeroplanes, so do any other simple man-made machines. The only reason we can't yet do it for you and me is because human beings are a lot more complicated. Now, I've already explained how we're sidestepping that complexity in a couple of very important ways, but we're not sidestepping all the complexity, because the damage itself, the linking stuff, the intermediates between metabolism and pathology, are the targets now. So we absolutely do have to embrace and somehow manage the complexity of the damage. So how complex is the damage? Well, it turns out, not very. It turns out that all of the various molecular and cellular changes that qualify as damage for this purpose can be classified into just 7 major categories, which is what I'm listing here on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, sorry. And you can see that these things, I mean, I won't go through them all right now, but the point is they are very concrete, down-to-earth, clear biological phenomena. So cell loss, what's that? It's simply cells dying and not being automatically replaced by the division of other cells. So in some organs or in some tissues, like the blood, for example, we've got constant and smooth turnover of cells. We've got stem cells that generate more of the cells that have gone away. In other places, like the brain and the heart, we don't have that. So, for example, Parkinson's disease is a disease caused by the death and non-replacement of a particular type of neuron called a dopaminergic neuron, which happens to have a much higher rate of death than most neurons. And, you know, we've all lost maybe a quarter of dopaminergic neurons by the time we get old. That's okay. There's that much margin of error in the system. But some people lose them a bit faster. They've lost maybe 3/4 and they get Parkinson's disease. And the first piece of really good news is that this classification doesn't seem to be changing. All of the categories I'm listing on the left-hand side have been clearly understood to exist, and they've been major topics of research and so on for at least 35 years in the biology of aging. That's a long time to find nothing out. And, you know, I mean, you could argue that maybe for a while people were not asking the right question. They weren't looking for categories like this. But, well, they have been for at least half that time, because I've been challenging my colleagues to come up with category number 8 and 9, and I seem to be getting away with it. You know, people are not actually succeeding in adding to this list, which is handy. That's very good news. But, of course, the really good news is the right-hand side of the table, the fact that for each type of damage, we have a generic therapy that should be able to work against any example within the category. So I already mentioned stem cell therapy. Of course, that is the way of repairing cell loss. If you do stem cell therapy in Parkinson's disease, you can replace the dopaminergic neurons, and that is an approach that people are very optimistic about. It's already very much in clinical trials and very much expected to pretty much cure Parkinson's disease. Certainly there have already been isolated cases when we were less good at manipulating stem cells in which people have been completely cured of Parkinson's disease for upwards of 20 years just with one stem cell transplant. The reason why Sense Research Foundation exists is because the other categories here are much less well-established, much more neglected, and we had to do quite a lot of work to give them credibility. But that's been very successful. I'll come back to that. That's been very successful. And so we've been able to even spin out companies to take many of these projects forward. So, yeah, life is good with regard to this. It's not going fast enough, but it's definitely moving. All right, here we go. Yes, so you probably are thinking these things. So let me see. I'll start with this one. This is the first piece of good news, peer review. We publish our work in the academic literature, and it gets published in very good journals. So, you know, it's clear that some people think that what we're doing is not completely useless. That's handy. And moreover, we have very world-leading scientists who have come out and publicly endorsed this approach and said that it's the way to go. All these 30 people here are absolute world leaders in their respective fields, and they're on our scientific advisory board. They have endorsed a very uncompromising assertion to the effect that damage repair is the way that we will bring aging under control, so that's nice. Perhaps what's nicest of all is that people are now coming along and reinventing this whole concept and pretending it's original. So this paper came out 5 years ago, and you know, they divided aging into 9 categories instead of 7, but that's not because they discovered new categories. It was just a different classification of the same list. The idea is basically just exactly identical. They've got their corresponding fixes. And the important thing about this is that unlike the situation when I first came along and was viewed as something of a heretic, this concept is now being very strongly embraced by everybody. So this paper, in fact, is going to become, by a long way, the most highly cited paper for this whole decade in the biology of aging. So, you know, that's pretty handy. So, yeah, the credential situation is sorted. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to say everything I just said, you know, because it wasn't true. People were giving me quite a hard time. But now, I seem to have won the argument, so to speak. Let's move away from the biology now and talk about what this all means for folks like you. Because the fact is, yes, you know, this is happening, but it's still research. And, you know, Einstein said it best. He said, if we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be called research. So, you know, we don't know how long this is going to take. I think that we've got a 50-50 chance of getting these technologies to a point that's really decisive within about 20 years. First of all, I know perfectly well that there's at least a 10% chance that we won't get there for 100 years. So, you know, there's a lot of speculation there. But what I can say is that there's a less than 10% chance that we will get there in 10 years. So I think that you might start out from a point of view of thinking, well, you know, I'll worry about that nearer the time and get on with my boring, normal way of thinking about things for the moment. And that's a reasonable thing to think until you hear what I'm going to tell you. So first thing I do want to emphasize is that, and I have to do this to a lot of audiences, is that we don't actually work on longevity. This longevity side effect of staying healthy however long ago you were born is still a side effect, even if the side effect is large. Now, we do think it's a good thing. It will put a lot of people out of business, including most of you, but fact is, you know, it's not what we work on. We work on health. We're interested in stopping people from getting sick when they get old. So how much longer are people going to live? Well, first thing I want to point out is a phenomenon that I've called longevity escape velocity. The therapies that I've already described to you today are not completely perfect panaceas. They will be pretty good. They will fix up most of the damage that the body does to itself throughout life, but not all, which means that my estimate currently is that we will only get about an additional 30 years of healthy life out of this. Now, 30 years is one hell of a lot. It's very nice, but let's face it, you know, it's only about twice what we've seen since World War II. You know, it's not completely unimaginable. So the question is, you know, is this really such a game changer? Thing is that these 30 years will not be for people who are born at the time that these therapies arrive. Because they are damage repair therapies, rejuvenation therapies, they will be applied to people who are already accumulating rust, you know, who are already in middle age or older at that time. And those people will not be just stopped in their aging tracks. They will actually be bona fide turned into biologically young people again. Think about that. Now, what this means is not only that people would be young again, but that we would have bought a whole bunch of time. 30 years down the road, these people are going to be biologically, let's say, 60 again for the second time, right? By which I mean they will have the same amount of damage in their bodies that they had before the therapies came along. And what's worse, the damage that they will have the second time will all be difficult damage, which we can define as simply the damage that the therapies don't work on, right? Whereas before, most of the damage was easy. And of course, that means that you can't get anywhere by using the same therapies. But 30 years is one hell of a long time in technology, including medical technology, which means that, of course, we won't be using the same therapies after when this original 60-year-old is now 90, but biologically 60 again. We'll be using Mark II. And those therapies will be a lot better, which means that we will be able to rejuvenate the same people and allow them to come back and not be biologically 60 for the third time until they're 150, and so on. This is what I call longevity escape velocity. It's simply the minimum rate at which we need to improve the therapies in order to stay one step ahead of the problem. And that rate is ridiculously modest. There is exactly zero chance that we will fail to maintain longevity escape velocity once we get there, once we get those first 30 years. So that's quite interesting. This slide I can go through really quickly because it's your bread and butter. You all know that in the Western world, people in their 20s or 30s don't have a particularly high mortality rate. And what I'm talking about is a situation in which the health, and therefore the risk of death per year, doesn't go up with age. Obviously, at the moment, it goes up by a nice round 10% per year. But it's not going to do that anymore. And when it doesn't, you know, you can do radioactive decay as easily as I can. You know, you're going to have four-digit lifespans on average. And, you know, the last line is something I like to mention to actuaries. If you recall the way that period life expectancy is calculated, it's obviously calculated by multiplying up probabilities, right, of the proportions of people who died at each age last year or whatever. Now, if you multiply all those proportions up to the oldest age that anyone has so far reached, and you've still not got below 50%, then you haven't got a period life expectancy anymore. You just literally can't calculate it. That's what's going to happen. We're going to be in a situation where mortality rates plummet so fast that most people currently alive will be expected to live longer than anyone has lived so far. That's another way of saying that you won't be able to calculate period life expectancy. So, we don't know how near it's going to be, as I said. I've given these estimates already. I think 50% chance that we'll get there in 20 years, but I'm not sure. Now, here, however, is the point that I really want to finish on and get through to you. The last point here, in red. Yes, it won't happen. This won't happen for at least 10 or 15 years, probably not for 20 years. You may think, well, that's a long time in my life. I'll probably be retired. But before then, we're going to see sufficient progress in the laboratory that people's expectations of how soon these things will come along will shift. Now, if you think about the psychology of that, you can see what I'm going to say next. When we get a sufficient amount of progress in the laboratory that it's not just me giving talks like this, it's all of my expert colleagues in gerontology who, unlike me, have, you know, reputations to protect and have the professorships and so on. When all of them come to the conclusion that it's actually safer to go on camera and on stage and say, yes, it's only a matter of time before these therapies come along, we have demonstrated sufficient proof of concept in mice and so on. When all of them are doing that, everything's going to change within, like, days. I mean, the following day, Oprah Winfrey and her counterparts around the world are going to be saying, well, if it's only a matter of time, then maybe we should kind of, you know, as such, make it less time and, you know, throw a bit of money at this. And the day after that, it will become impossible to get elected unless you have a manifesto commitment to have a war on aging. And I mean a proper war. I don't mean like the war on cancer, which was hardly any money, really. So that's quite, like, there's going to be a lot of pandemonium. But also, from your point of view, people's expectation is going to be that the war will be won fairly soon, in time for them. I'm talking about people who pay taxes and who buy insurance and so on. That means that they're going to make their choices of what insurance premiums, what insurance policies to buy, you know, what health insurance to get, you know, what pensions to have, on the basis of a completely step-changed expectation of how long they're going to live. Now, I don't have to tell people like you that that means rather a lot insofar as it matters. You know, I mean, it's so... I mean, how did I actually need to have to give that answer? How many milliseconds should it have taken all of you to figure that out? You know, and the others are all the same.
All right. Well, that was a really bad buy myself time tactic. Let's go to the SMS questions. do we have... The microphones are here as well if anyone wants to jump up and ask a question, but if we could flip back to the SMS questions. I keep doing that, please. That would be great.
All right, I'll answer another one while we're waiting. Okay. Overpopulation, right. I mean, come on. What is overpopulation? It's obviously the, you know, having more people on the planet than the planet can sustain with an acceptable level of environmental impact. So today we have overpopulation. We have climate change and all that. But hello, look at all these other technologies that are coming along to fix that. And they're not even coming along because of the perception that climate change is a problem. They're coming along just because, you know, renewable energy is becoming cheaper than fossil fuels and we're figuring out how to do artificial meat and desalination on a big scale and so on. You know, the carrying capacity of the planet is absolutely certain to rise faster, much faster, than the population would rise even if we completely eliminated all death from any cause today and we didn't even lower fertility rates any further. You know.
Okay, there's an... question come up from SMS. What is the evolutionary need for the metabolism to generate damage? What may be unintended consequences of repairing the damage?
Yeah, there is no evolutionary need. Way back in the late 1800s, shortly after Darwin, there was a very famous and well-respected, perhaps too well-respected, biologist in Germany named August Weismann, who started thinking about the problem of why aging exists. And he pretty much asked it in exactly this way. He said, well, okay, look, evolution's really smart, therefore evolution would have been able to get rid of aging if it had wanted to, therefore it must have wanted to keep aging, or to have aging. You know, this is kind of, like, sounds seductive at first, but if you think about it, it's not really seductive, because first of all, in the wild, hardly any animals actually die of aging. They've all, you know, we've got predation and, you know, hypothermia and starvation and so on. That causes turnover of the population perfectly well, aging or no aging. Secondly, if you did want aging to happen, you don't need evolution to create it. You just need gaps in the anti-aging machinery that we have that slows down the rate of the accumulation of these various types of damage. So it's now basically universally agreed by specialists that the reason we have aging is not because... somebody put it very well. They said, aging is a product of evolutionary neglect, not evolutionary intent. So, you know, there's really, you know, the idea that there would be unintended consequences of repairing the damage is rather like saying there would be unintended consequences of you know, repairing the damage to a car. And there aren't.
So a question, I guess, of clarification. You talked about being able to reverse the damage and maybe take your biological clock back on some counts 30 years. The question is, does it this stop just stop ageing or can it actually reverse it?
Well, I mean, what do you call it? I mean, ageing is the process of creation of the damage, right? The process of accumulation of the damage. So you could call repairing the damage reversing ageing, but of course it's not reversing the actual chemistry. It's you know, it's taking it back to the level of damage that you had before.
Someone's asking, have you bought a lifetime annuity? Good actuarial question there. Of all the research you and others are doing, and I know you're in touch with a lot of other scientists around the world, what is there one piece of research that you think will make the biggest difference? I mean, you talked about all the categories of damage. What do you think is going to turn the dial?
Yeah, no, I don't think there will be one. Basically, all of those categories of damage can kill you pretty much on schedule on their own, however well you fix all the others. So you've totally got to attack them all. And that's really why our priorities at the Foundation are all around making sure that nothing gets left behind. You know, there's a huge amount of bias within the academic community and within industry in terms of research to be short-termist and to prioritise low-hanging fruit, which, of course, is very much not what you want to do in a divide-and-conquer situation like we're in here. So we exist to counterbalance that and to work on the most difficult things for as long as it takes to get them to the point of sufficient proof of concept that, you know, companies and so on will get involved.
This therapy sounds expensive. Will only the rich be able to afford
it? Yeah, that was one of the things I put my Red Cross through. Think about it. How expensive... I mean, you guys know the answer to this question. How expensive is aging? How much of our medical budget do we spend today on the ill health of old age? And on top of that, that's just, of course, the direct cost. How much does it cost the economy that the elderly can't actually contribute any wealth to society because they're too sick? You know, how much does it cost the economy that the kids of the elderly are less efficient because they've got to look after their sick parents? It's insane. Which means that, yes, of course these therapies will be expensive to deliver at first, same as any new technology is, but in terms of the amount of money they save, they will pay for themselves at the level of the national level, you know, just ridiculously many times over, ridiculously fast. So putting it another way, you know, it would be economically totally suicidal for any country not to make sure that these therapies are available irrespective of ability to pay to anyone who's old enough to need them, because they will pay for themselves. And it doesn't matter whether that's done through a single-payer system or a private system like in the US. It doesn't matter whether the country is, you know, tax-phobic the way the US is. Because the fact is, you know, we've already got precedent. You don't want to look at today's high-tech medicine as a precedent, because, of course, everything I just said doesn't apply to today's high-tech medicine for the elderly, because that medicine doesn't work. So you don't get the economic benefit. You just spend a lot of money to modestly postpone the extend the time when people are sick, you know, which obviously is not economically beneficial. The precedent that we have is basic education.
It pays for itself, or more than pays for itself.
That's right. The precedent for this that we have is basic education, which even in the US, even if that ridiculously tax-averse country that I currently live in, it's free for everybody. Because it bloody better be, because if you don't do that, then 20 years down the road, you're not going to have a workforce.
We started this conference yesterday hearing about a session on basically well-being and, you know, improving people's lifestyles to help them have healthier lives, claim less insurance, reduce costs, those sorts of things. What interaction is there between the lifestyle we lead and lifespans, do you think, and what do you do yourself?
There's not very much. Not with regard to the things we have a choice about. I mean, obviously, there are choices we can make that can shorten our lifespans, like smoking, getting seriously overweight. But the interesting comparison is not between a normal, well-behaved lifestyle versus a really bad one. The interesting question is between a normal, well-behaved one and the absolute optimum that we could do. Okay. And as far as anyone can tell, that margin is tiny. You know, we can even throw in a little bit of genetics here and there, and it still doesn't make much difference. If you look at the difference between, you know, the US and Japan, for example. So, you know, people laugh at the US a lot because, of course, they come down around number like 45 or something in the league table of life expectancy, despite the fact that they spend more per head on medical care than anywhere else. But, hello, if you look at the actual numbers, it's only a difference of 5 years of life expectancy, which is, you know, not a lot, really. Better than nothing, obviously, but... So, yes, there's absolute... And, you know, I could give plenty of other ways of looking at it, but basically it's hardly anything. The things that really matter, that really are driving ageing, are unfortunately not lifestyle in the normal sense of the word. The single worst thing that all of you right now are doing that is affecting your ageing is breathing. And I don't mean breathing polluted air, I mean the oxygen, because the way in which the body uses oxygen is to combine it with nutrients to extract energy from the nutrients. That's a very hairy chemical process that creates toxic molecules called free radicals. But breathing is a little bit non-negotiable, really. So, all right, I'm going to do some of this.
So which one do you want to go for?
I'm going to do the middle one. So it's earlier, some of the damage that we're seeing in 70 or 80-year-olds is new to us. What new damage types might we see in young 130-year-olds? Great question. Actually, the premise is not true, though. We have not discovered any new types of damage. Even if we look at the consequences, the pathologies, you know, Alzheimer's disease was defined by Alois Alzheimer in 1908, and that's a relatively recent one. You know, all of these things have become much more abundant, much more prevalent as a result of the success we've had in stopping people from dying in childbirth and in infancy and so on. But they were certainly prevalent enough to be known about a very long time ago.
And do you think that's why we haven't really progressed on a lot of these things?
No.
Because they weren't
it's
that
because,
important
it's
before.
It's not because we're not trying. It's not because we weren't trying, no. It's because they genuinely are harder.
But
I wanted to finish that question, though, because... the question still is, you know, will we come across category number 8 when we have people a bit elder? Conceivably, but it's looking very unlikely. We certainly would expect to get new examples within the 7 categories, but we know enough about how the body works now that it would be quite a surprise if we had a radically new category that emerged.
Someone's asking a positive question, a third one there. If we had lifespans of 1,000 years and personal growth and development over that time, what sort of effects would that have on the world?
Honestly, one thing that frustrates me a lot is the idea that we might be able to say anything remotely intelligent about the world more than 100 years from now. You know, I mean, quite clearly, we haven't the faintest idea what's going to be different. You know, 25 years ago, we didn't have the internet. Goodness me. I mean, that's a kind of a problem I'd like to have. A great question here, is there any incentive to eat healthy and be active if we can just repair the damage? Well, you're absolutely right, but of course it increases the incentive right now before the therapies come along, because we don't know how soon they're going to come along.
Stay alive for the next 30 years to get there. Okay.
Yeah.
Then we could all be fat and lazy. Great.
Someone said, please don't buy a pension from us, we'd have to turn you down. Yeah.
I'm redundant here, go for it. This is great.
But there's a question about Parkinson's here. Yes, okay, so yes, the work that I talked about has not really hit the headlines yet, because we are talking about simply clinical trials that are a relatively early stage. Nevertheless, the basis for the optimism I spoke about in those clinical trials is very solid. The very first time stem cells were used against Parkinson's was in a trial in Sweden about 25 years ago, and the people I mentioned who were completely cured for that long from that trial. You know, it's ridiculous. They got one injection. A couple of years later, they were taken off all other therapies, and you know, they haven't had any symptoms. It just works.
So why has that not been?
Because the only reason it worked back then was because of luck. Essentially, we didn't know much then about how to manipulate stem cells into the laboratory so that they were the right type of stem cell that we could inject. So most people didn't get any benefit because they never got the right kind of stem cell that turned into the right kind of neuron. Now we know how to do that kind of stuff.
Real expectation of an imminent cure.
Yep. Who's providing the funding at the moment? Funding for the foundation is philanthropic, or basically all of it. We have a few very wealthy donors who have given us a nice amount. That accounts for maybe three-quarters of our budget. We also have plenty of grassroots funding from thousands and thousands of other people who give us, you know, $10 a month or $1,000 a month. And, you know, if we had more of that, that would be very nice. So
if you're within 20 to 30 years of your life expectancy, you might want to donate to sends.org. And I heard you say, actually, you're running on about $5 million a year now.
Yep.
And you said if you had $20 million a year, you could go three times as fast.
Well, certainly if we have $50 million, yeah.
$50 million.
I said another
zero. Up in the adder, you did say 50, you're right.
I said another zero.
Not 10 times as fast, but three times as fast. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But reproductive life, yes, it would. Yeah, the ovary is just another organ. So if we can repair everything else, we can certainly repair that. Of course, you know, for those of you who are looking forward to menopause, we will be able to turn it on and off. Yes, right. You won't.
Okay, so till death do us part, we'll divorce.
Well, of course, it's already happened, hasn't it? You know, I mean, the number of people who have multiple partnerships throughout their life now is far greater than it used to be.
How easy is it to get stem cells to immunise all these people?
Oh, well, I mean, it's become easier. It's becoming easier all the time. So you'll probably remember that 15 years ago, there was a huge furor in the US because people were looking at the possibility of using embryonic stem cells to treat various diseases, and some people thought that embryos were too close to being alive. But we don't need to do that anymore, because a group in Japan in 2006 showed how to take regular cells that are not even stem cells at all and turn back their developmental clock so that they are just as primitive as embryonic stem cells, and you can make what you like from those things. And it's really rather easy to do, which means that you can actually do what's called autologous stem cell therapy. In other words, stem cell therapy with cells that were originally from the person you're giving them back to, except they weren't stem cells.
So I've got a question here about, do you take any supplements? So what are you doing to get yourself to the next 20 to 30 years?
Don't do as I do as I say. Because, because first of all, I'm just genetically very lucky. I mean, I've had the good fortune to be very thoroughly tested five times over the past 15 years or so on 150 different things in my blood, you know, the most high-end kinds of tests, and I always come out biologically ridiculously young. So I'm just lucky that way.
But also, whoever he applies to an annuity for, yeah.
But also, I'm running this crusade to end aging, and it's quite exhausting, really. So I don't get nearly enough sleep, which is definitely bad for me.
Yes, I've seen your travel schedule.
Are we going to live forever and have AI do all the work? Absolutely. I used to be an artificial intelligence researcher before I was a biologist, actually, and it's moving on ahead pretty quickly now, as I'm sure all of you know. I think that, in fact, the bulk of the impact of AI in terms of automation will already have rolled out before the therapies that I'm working on even arrive.
What will the specialist who cure aging be called?
Well, I have no idea. I mean, I guess you can't really call them gerontologists anymore because they won't be studying aging anymore. They'll be on the medical side. But you wouldn't want to really call them geriatricians either. I'm not really sure.
It's going to put plastic surgeons out of business as well, probably. Yeah. So final question here, an interesting one about mental health. Would it be an unintended consequence of longer lifespans?
I'm sorry, I've been asked. Come back to that one. But I've,
okay.
But it's very hard to control. This one at the top says, I'm asking for a friend. and it says, are any currently available supplements effective? I say basically no. A number of my friends have done the pioneering work to demonstrate the potential effectiveness of these things, and they are also running or at least advising companies like this, so I definitely piss people off, friends of mine, quite a bit when I say this. But the fact is, it's not looking very good for any of these things, because pretty much all of them work on the basis of trying to trick the body into thinking it's being starved, it's in a famine. We know, and we've known since the 1930s, that if you take mice or rats and you feed them maybe 30 or 40% less than they would like, then they live a lot longer. They live like 30 or 40% longer.
Do they live longer, or does it just feel like that?
Oh, no, you can't claim originality for that joke, I'm afraid. But they do live longer, a lot longer, and they're healthy for that extra time. So this is all wonderful, and people have studied it a great deal, and people eventually figured out, about 30 years ago, how to achieve the same kind of thing genetically. And more recently than that, they figured out how to do the same kind of thing pharmacologically, which is pretty damn cool. But there's a bit of a problem, which is that we've tried it on a bunch of different species now, of very different longevities, and it turns out to work far less well on longer-lived species than on shorter-lived ones. So that's an easy thing to explain from evolutionary theory, so it shouldn't be a surprise, but it's not just not a surprise, it's true. And that's a shame, because we already are a long-lived species. So it's very unlikely that we will get very much out of it. Now, what these things might be able to do is somewhat protect the body against the ill health associated with old age that we can already deal with in some ways. For example, one of the most important drugs in this whole space is metformin, which originally has been just thought of as an anti-diabetes drug, and people are now trying to claim it affects aging more generally than diabetes. But ultimately, it's a protector against things that we can already protect against reasonably well just by not being stupid.
Well, look, there's a lot more questions, but we might have to leave it there. Please join me in thanking Dr. Aubrey de Grey for fascinating talk.